then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's February the 27th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Right. I've been getting bombarded with emails asking me what I think about the coup d'etat in the Ukraine. On the surface, it seems like an excellent example of white people rising up in arms to run a corrupt neo-Marxist dictator out of office. And to be sure, this guy Yanukovych is no prize. The question is this lingerie model Timoshenko, who seems to be the poster girl for the coup, going to be any better? I would like to have a more clear idea of just who is behind all this before I make any snap judgments, because I do know this. Bringing one of the few remaining more or less all-white countries in the world into the European Union is a bad, bad, bad idea. Does the Ukraine really need hate crime laws and racial incitement laws and Holocaust denial laws and waves of African and Muslim immigrants? I'll be honest, right now this whole thing smacks of a CIA-inspired color revolution. Who brought all those thousands of demonstrators to Kiev in the middle of the winter, and who gave them heat and food for 10 days or 2 weeks, however long it lasted? Somebody had to pay for all the buses and the warming tents and the food and the bunks, cots, or whatever. Who paid for all of that? Who exactly organized all that sound and fury? Who was giving the orders and directing the mob? The media had no hesitation about screaming out the name of the Muslim Brotherhood when it happened in Egypt and Tunisia, but in the Ukraine they've been very, very quiet. Secondly, qui bono? Who benefits? Who benefits if the Ukraine breaks all ties with Russia and comes galumphing over to the so-called Western democracies? The so-called Western world, which ain't so Western anymore, is now united in an attempt to put a stop to Vladimir Putin's Russia, especially since Putin cracked down on buggery in his country. We need to bear in mind that homosexuality is now pretty much America's prime cultural export, and the faggot wing of the Democrat Party seems to be pretty much in charge of everything now, including foreign policy. It's no coincidence that countries like Russia, China, and India, which are America's main economic competitors, as well as other third world nations like Nigeria and Uganda, are now criminalizing and outlawing buggery. They know it weakens their people and their culture and cuts into their national and racial birth rates, something Americans don't seem to have figured out yet. I noticed something else. The southern and eastern part of Ukraine, which are ethnically Russian, aren't having any. There has already been a kind of counter-coup in Sevastopol on the Black Sea, and most of the local government has more or less seceded from the Kiev regime, and they're setting up what are euphemistically called civil defense squads throughout large parts of Russian Ukraine. So it looks like there may be more to this than meets the eye. It could well be payback for Putin preventing an American and Israeli attack on Syria last year. Guys, let's let this one play out a bit more before we start shouting the odds, okay? Above all, I want to see what Putin does and how far he's willing to back Yanukovych. Now, unfortunately, we have some more goo-boo news. Some of you may know or have heard of a guy in South Carolina named August Kreis. He claims to be Generalissimo of one of the 14 different Aryan Nations factions, none of which have ever been able to get anywhere because there's only about 5 or 6 guys apiece involved in them. They're all dirt poor, and they can't afford a clubhouse or any land out in the sticks anywhere. And I'm sorry to say that with American white nationalists, it's always been about the clubhouse. Now that nobody has any land or any buildings anymore, we've all fallen on hard times, but there will be a time and a place for that discussion. Now, last week, August Christ was arrested in Lexington, South Carolina, on some kind of kiddie porn or child sex charge. The only article I've seen on it is from the Southern Poverty Law Center, gleefully republished in Salon magazine, and that source simply isn't sufficiently reliable to be quoted, but apparently he is in fact in jail on some charge or other. Now, I do not know August Christ. I never met him. I knew of him second or third hand off the internet, and that's about all. But as is the intention, of course, something like this tarnishes us all. Although by now we're all so encrusted with hardened bird turd from year after year of this kind of thing that I doubt this will do too much more damage than wasn't already done before. One of our biggest problems is what Rush Limbaugh refers to as low-information voters, read white dumbasses, and they actually believe this stereotype of us portrayed on television and Hollywood as ignorant rednecks who abuse women and beat our wives and molest our children. Why, all white male husbands and fathers beat their wives and molest their children. Didn't you know that? Which is why all you little girls should never, ever marry one, according to Salon and Huffington Post. I'm sure Christ will take the line that he was framed by the FBI, and for all I know, he may be entirely correct. They're certainly not above it. Certainly, in the light of the Edgar Steele and Bill White and Matt Hale cases, there is no moral or legal restraint of any kind on the FBI's penchant for perjury and the fabrication of false evidence against anybody they care to victimize. Or it could be that we have once again failed to exercise any control over who is publicly associated with us, and by allowing self-appointment as a so-called white leader, we've opened ourselves up to excruciating embarrassment by another creep. I don't know the man, and so I'm not going to speculate, but I can tell you this, he's done for. Because in this society, all that needs to happen is for that charge to be leveled at all, at any time. And it's like a medieval accusation of witchcraft. There is no defense, and there's no coming back from it. Whatever the facts of his case, August Christ is now toast. We need to sit down and figure out some way that we can at least make some kind of attempt to keep all these sketchy people that America has created away from us so that these things don't rise up to bite us in the butt all the time, hence my insistence on things like full background checks with Social Security numbers and date of birth. If any of you have any questions about that policy, I can give you a whole list of names, and August Christ is just the beginning of it. Okay, to get some of the bad taste out of our mouths, let's see if we can't make this episode of Radio Free Northwest a kind of white history show to cap off Black History Month. I've said this before, there are names in our past that every white man and woman ought to know, from long before the days of weirdos and druggies and sexually strange little men, when we drew our leaders directly from the once mighty American heartland. Now, one of those names that white people should know is that of the Reverend Gerald L.K. Smith. Smith was an aide and confidant of the Kingfish himself, Senator Huey Long. And after Long was murdered by the Jews in 1935, Smith went on to found the Christian Nationalist Crusade. I actually corresponded briefly with Smith in his old age when I'd just come in as editor of the White Power newspaper for the old Arlington Group. Smith died in 1976, but this recording I'm going to play for you is from the late 1950s. Now, you'll recall that I've mentioned in the past how early right-wing meetings consisted of people getting together in somebody's living room in the suburbs or some little moose lodge or church fellowship hall and playing a tape on a boombox from whoever the fearless leader was at the time, telling them all about the world conspiracy to push integration or the United Nations or fluoride in the water, whatever. Well, I'm not sure, but I think this is one of those, although in the late 50s, Smith would have used a reel-to-reel tape or maybe a vinyl phonograph record. Now, this is actually a good example of its kind. The whole thing is a bit too long for a single RFN episode, so I'll play you part one now and part two next week. Now, this will give you a good feel about what we were doing back in the days when we were in a majority in this country, and we could have been doing something else effective if we'd had the leadership and the balls.
The transcribed message which you are about to hear represents a desperate and consecrated determination on the part of fearless patriots to reach you with truth which is being scientifically censored out of our daily papers, out of our radio programs, and out of our television broadcasts. This message would constitute a waste of effort and money if it contained truth which you could pick up at any newsstand or hear from day to day in the radio and television broadcasts. Shortly before these words were recorded, there was placed in my hand a report. A report from a great citizen of intelligence and character. Time will not permit me to read you the full report, but I will read enough of it to challenge your attention. Unless, of course, you have been completely drugged and rendered insensible by the hypnotism of our controlled propaganda machine. I'm not giving the name of the important citizen who made this report, which I am about to quote, because I do not care to bring down upon his head unnecessary persecution. Here is a portion of his written report. I quote, 10 years more, that's about all. 15, maybe, at the outside. By then, the Reds will have taken over America. No war, no hydrogen bombs, no mass slaughter till after the victory has been won. The coup d'etat in course of accomplishment, even while you and I are reading these lines, will be engineered to final success by the entrenched and untouchable traitors, traitors in high places, aided and abetted by their strategically placed cohorts in the nerve centers of our nation. I continue to quote from the report. The men who sold 500 million Chinese into communist slavery will finally betray America. The saboteurs who ordered ignominious defeat in Korea will at last achieve the utter destruction of the nation that has too long stood between Russia's communist leaders and a bloody communist world. It will be the fulfillment of the prophecy made by Nikolai Lenin in 1923 when he said, first, we will take Eastern Europe, then the masses of Asia, then we will encircle the United States, which will be the last bastion of capitalism. We will not have to attack. It will fall like overripe fruit into our hands. End the quotation of Lenin. I now resume the quotation from the confidential report. Who are these traitors? In what key spots are they located right now? Apparently, we are not to know until it is too late. It is worse than useless. It is military or political suicide for any individual to attempt to track them down, for the end is ever the same. Character assassination, disgrace, or even death. That ends the quotation of the confidential report. A sincere Christian patriot must do one of two things with this statement. First, he can dismiss it as untrue, but I tell you that in my files and in the files of the Christian Nationalist Crusade, of which I am the national director, we have the evidence. Evidence to support the apprehensions contained in this quoted report. Therefore, no patriot who has heard this warning can claim to be sincere until he has gone to the bottom of this question. The second treatment that can be given to this warning is to believe it and to act on it. The Christian Nationalist Crusade, which is a national committee, functions on the following premises. First, that this is a constitutional republic which has grown out of the teachings and the ideals of Christian civilization. Second, that the enemies of Christ and our way of life have organized a worldwide conspiracy and a worldwide plot to destroy this constitutional republic and all Christian civilization. Third, it is our duty as patriots to enlighten ourselves and band ourselves together in a devoted and consecrated effort to save America from this conspiracy. Fourth, in doing this, we must be enlightened concerning the true tradition of Americanism. We must become informed as to the techniques being employed to destroy us, and we must familiarize ourselves with the names of the organizations and the personalities engaged in this satanic, destructive, diabolical effort. Fifth, based on this information, we must act with intelligence, strength, courage, and Christian faith. I am sorry to tell you something. It grieves me to tell you that expensive organizations have been formed, newspapers have been subdued, propaganda agencies have been captured, which are now in the daily 24-hour business of undermining every one of the great features of our constitutional republic. Behind this conspiracy to destroy our republic is the same evil, Christ-hating political machine which brought about the Russian Revolution, which lowered the Iron Curtain over the eastern half of Europe, and which has enveloped 500 million additional human beings in Asia with the savage tyranny of death, torture, and enslavement. In the light of the natural decency of the American people, the world conspirators know that crude methods cannot be employed effectively in the United States. Therefore, the old simile applies. We are being destroyed by wolves in sheep's clothing. They have crept into our schools. They are in our colleges. They are in our pulpits. They have taken over cultural organizations, political parties, newspapers, broadcasting facilities, television stations. Many people who are doing the work of destruction are not communists. In fact, they think they are opposed to communism. They are serving as the innocent tools of the most ruthless conspiracy of destruction ever plotted against a civilized people. The study of this conspiracy is as complex as the study of geology or cancer. America has spent millions and billions in the study of the constructive sciences involving medicine, public health, highways, mineralogy, transportation, finance. But there are only a few of us who have given our whole lives to the study of the conspiracy against our Christian American way of life. Since so few people are scientifically and thoroughly informed, it makes it difficult for us to get our message over. The powerful manipulators, operating from behind the scenes in their ruthless determination to keep this truth from the people, have vowed that anyone of influence and character who dares lift a voice to warn the people shall be struck down with smear, ridicule, persecution, character assassination, imprisonment, or even death. I will list a few great citizens who have warned the people and have been struck down or impaired by the ruthless weapons of abuse. They include Charles A. Lindbergh, Reverend Charles Coughlin, Congressman Martin Dyes, Congressman John E. Rankin, Congressman Parnell Thomas, Senator Jack B. Tenney, Senator Joseph McCarthy, General Douglas MacArthur, the late Senator Pat McCarran, and of course, no man in America has been ridiculed and smeared more than the one to whom you are now listening. Here are some unmistakable symptoms of treason which have not been satisfactorily explained to the American people. I defy any person posing as an intelligent American citizen to ignore what I am about to tell you. Five generals and admirals testified before the Internal Security Committee of the United States Senate that they were ordered to take steps leading to defeat in Korea. Contrary to their best judgment, contrary to their personal desires, contrary even to military and naval intelligence at hand, Senator McCarthy was struck down and the files were ordered closed just as he was about to obtain information concerning the mysterious orders that went out from Washington to these five generals and admiral. Among those who testified to the effect that they were virtually ordered to lose a war for America in favor of communism were the following. General Douglas MacArthur so testified. General James Van Fleet so testified. Admiral Charles Turner Joy so testified, General Mark Clark so testified, and General George Stratemeyer so testified. During my most recent visit to Washington, D.C., I was told by a person of unimpeachable character and unquestioned wisdom that the Congress of the United States has been so terrorized because of what has been done to Senator McCarthy that they are now afraid for their lives, their reputations, and their political futures if they were to take any further steps to uncover the treasonable orders that went out of Washington, D.C. to these generals and admirals who knew how to win a war and were not permitted so to do. Reference to our defeat in Korea is not intended to create the impression of thoroughness in the exposition of this subject. I give it merely to illustrate how deadly and powerful the conspiracy is. It stands to reason. If hidden hand forces in and near our government in Washington are powerful enough to force generals and admirals to act against their best judgment in the prosecution of the war, then the time has come for the American people to know who these unseen, hidden hand, powerful personalities are. Senator McCarthy and Senator Jenner got closer, to use the figure, they got closer to pay dirt and closer to the real information than anyone thus far. But what happened to them? Bureaucrats in Washington, with authority to act, have threatened government employees with prison if they dare turn any of this material over to Senator McCarthy, Senator Jenner, or anyone in a position of similar authority and interest. The time has come for me to raise this question. Who is behind this hidden hand, communist, Christ-hating, world revolution and conspiracy? What individuals, what organizations are feeding this plot with money, with ideas, with leadership? You are about to hear truth which could cost me my liberty. Yes, it could cost me my life. But I must speak it, and here it is. When the Christ-hating savages of communist leadership had burned the churches, slaughtered the police, and overthrown the government of Russia, 300 commissars came to power. Of these 300 commissars whose hands were dripping with blood, I must tell you this, of these 300 commissars whose hands were dripping with blood, 290 were Jews. 3 years following the October Revolution, which outlawed the church, crucified the Christian, America's most influential Jewish periodical, known as the American Hebrew, published in New York City, said on its editorial page, I quote, remember, I am quoting from the most influential Jewish periodical in the United States. Here it is. The Bolshevist Revolution in Russia was the work of Jewish brains, of Jewish dissatisfaction, of Jewish planning, whose goal is to create a new order in the world. What was performed in so excellent a way in Russia, thanks to Jewish brains and because of Jewish dissatisfaction, and by Jewish planning, shall also, through the same Jewish mental and physical forces, become a reality all over the world. End the quotation taken from America's most influential Jewish journal, The American Hebrew.
Okay, haven't had any loud crashing rock music on here for a while, so let's bust it loose. I don't know who this is, but it's called The Beast of America. And yeah, I know, at first it sounds a little negroid, but I listen closely and I think these are white girls. Well, white-ish anyway. Anyway, give it a listen and see what you think.
Lay down like a naked dead body. Keep it real for the people working overtime. They can't stay living off the government's dime. Stand tall for the people of America. Stand tall for the man next door. We are free in the land of America. We ain't going down like this. Come on now.
I never cease to be amazed at the fact that there are people today, especially young kids, who claim to be white nationalists or even national socialists, and they have no idea on earth who Ezra Pound was. We really are that completely divorced from our past. I'm not going to take the time to explain it here again, since I've already done so on several occasions before. If you don't know who he was, hop on your Google and look him up. This is another recording from the late 1950s sometime. The title was Ezra Pound Speaks for the Record, explaining why he made radio broadcasts from fascist Italy during the war. Now, you should bear in mind that Pound was an elderly man when this was made, and his health was bad due to repeated American and Jewish attempts to murder him through deliberate neglect, exposure, keeping him in a cage outdoors for almost a year, that kind of thing. I'm not sure, but this may even have been one of the many recordings he made for people who visited him in St. Elizabeth's Nut House, where he was confined for so many years. Apparently, the American government finally decided it wouldn't be seemly to execute or simply murder a man for political reasons who is generally regarded to this day as the foremost American poet of the 20th century. Now, one of those people who visited him in St. Elizabeth's, and if memory serves, made some recordings as well, was Commander George Lincoln Rockwell. This is Ezra Pound speaking for the record.
I have never said that the executive should never exceed his powers. Jefferson did so in the case of the Louisiana Purchase and was justified. I have affirmed that when the executive exceeds his legal powers, if no one protests, you will lose all of your liberties. The four steps in my pilgrimage, of them, the first occurred in Paris during the armistice after the 1914 war. I had had permission to go to Lewes, and when I attempted to get back to London, I went to the consulate for my visa, the American consulate, and the whippersnapper back at the desk said that all Americans were to return to America. I pointed out that my means of livelihood, all my possessions, my flat, were in London, upon which he disappeared behind a partition, and a nasty little whining voice was heard saying, "We want them all to go back." Key words here are "we want." We want. The next man they were picking on was a naval captain who hadn't got some postage stamp or other on his leave to come to Paris for a fortnight. So we got into a taxi, the captain and I, and went around to the embassy. By a million to one chance, the only American ambassador at that time who had had a law office, that is a wooden shack about 20 feet square in the Rocky Mountains in 1885-6, was in Paris. And my father, who remembered him in the frontier days, a mild sort of frontier, but still, Mr. Wallace at that time had jumped back into his shop to get his six-shooter for a purpose from which my father dissuaded him. Dad had said, "If you're in Paris, go in and say hello to Hugh Wallace." By the grace of God, I had gone in to see Mr. Wallace. I found a very elegant, very gentle, white-haired man sitting behind a desk. Very gentle, very fatigued, and he asked if he could do anything for me, and I said, "No, Dad said if I was in Paris to come in and say hello to you." So, not having needed anything the day before, when the naval captain and I arrived with our tale of woe, Mr. Wallace, Hugh Wallace, no relation of Henry, sent us a chit back to the consulate, and our visas and permits were put in order. My argument was that if these whippersnappers were trying to push me around, they were probably trying it on many other people. And I then began my campaign in the Paris edition of the Chicago Tribune against the passport nuisance. Having wandered around Europe some years before with nothing in the way of cards of identity except an unstamped membership ticket in the Touring Club de France. Wilson, of course, in putting the $10 visa on passports, had penalized American students. the desirable or undesirable immigrant paid $10 to get into the U.S. The unfortunate American student who wanted to visit several countries in Europe got soaked from $30 to $50. The key word here was, we want. The next item, I mentioned these troubles to a lanky ex-Dutchman by the name of Van Dyne, no relation of Mr. Willard Huntington Wright, who wrote detective stories with that pseudonym. Van Dyne had taken out his first nationalization papers, but not his second. He was called up for the army, so he went before the tribunal in Chicago and said, I'm perfectly willing to fight in your army, but if I'm American enough to fight in your army, I got a right not to be taxed as a foreigner. He said the presiding officer leaned over the bench and said, Say, young feller, don't you know that in this country there ain't nobody has got any goddamn rights whatsoever? That is the second step. The third step, mentioning these two items to the prosecuting attorney for one of our largest cities, the comment offered was, All I'm interested in is bunk, seeing what you can put over. Anglicé, all that I am interested in is bunk, seeing what you can put over. The discrepancy between this attitude toward the law and that of the founding fathers, the distance between Boston in John Adams' time and one of our larger cities in 1923 is considerable. I mentioned these three points to Senator Wheeler when I was in Washington in 39 trying to see if there was any way of staving off the war, which followed later that year. And Senator Wheeler's comment was, Well, what do you expect? He's packed the Supreme Court so they will declare anything he does constitutional. Now, that is where I took off from. When the senator is unable to prevent breaches of the Constitution, and of course the senator, if he is not re-elected, is nobody, when the senator cannot function, the duty, as I see it, falls back onto the individual citizen. And that is why, after 2 years of wangling, when I got hold of a microphone in Rome, I used it. That, I think, is the necessary minimum, and a good deal has at last been verified and set down. That's all I wish to put onto this recording, for the record.
Here's Andy.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andy Donner here. Weeks ago, following the State of the Union address in January of this year, I promised a response on Radio Free Northwest. While I did mention this response would be delayed, I hadn't thought it would be as delayed as this. As seems to be the trend, when I want to make a few passing remarks on a topic, there's a perfect storm around said topic and I end up needing to make extended remarks across a number of Radio Free Northwest episodes. Sure enough, I've been forced by recent events to start a new series on real politics as they relate to the Northwest Front. Before I start that, I probably ought to justify the need for this particular series. This might not go over so well, since most of you are probably not interested in hearing about GOP entryism and background checks. In all honesty, neither am I. My own personal preferences aside, I have to note the responses on the subjects have been a little strange. As has been pointed out on this program, a minority of the respondents haven't been able to process the material correctly. Not only that, I've seen quite a bit wrong in a white nationalist discussion area I was invited to a couple months ago. I'm regularly exhorting you all to approach politics from a rational, responsible perspective. It's unfair for me to keep that up when there's clearly a problem with newer white nationalists not growing out of their previous politics or not clearly processing racial matters. These issues might be among the rare cases where I'm talking about specific people on Radio Free Northwest, but they're not known movement personalities. I won't name them and I won't bark at them since they, with precious few exceptions, aren't actually doing anything wrong. I did my political growing before any of my racial tendencies kicked in. When I found the party, I was able to quickly and accurately assess whether or not I needed to commit to the Northwest imperative. That's a somewhat unique sequence of events, and I had the benefit of a decent political education before ever considering the racial facets of our current predicament. It dawned on me recently that not everyone the Northwest Front reaches has the requisite background knowledge to fully process everything the party presents them with. Just a moment ago, I mentioned the matter of a decent political education. While I do aspire to dispensing as much sound political reality as is possible in this medium, I won't pretend that my own understanding is as developed as it could be. There are, after all, only so many hours in the day, and I can't be too upset if many white nationalists, new and old, don't understand concepts which, in all honesty, are arcane to the modern white man and woman. To say as little as possible on the matter, I should note that I have an excessively long list of books I hope to read at some point soon. If nothing else, I would hope that those of you with Northwest aspirations will make similar efforts in the immediate future. I cannot imagine myself to be unique in the world, and there must be some among you who would, if willing to change yourselves, determine to undertake the Northwest migration and the Butler Plan to secure an existence for our people and a future for white children. Now, as for GOP entryism, I can't stand the idea. Don't get me wrong, I'm all for it. It just makes me sick. I don't like mucking around in system politics, and while GOP entryism is no such thing, it comes awfully close. Nevertheless, if people in general are going to discuss race in an open way, we've got to participate. The conditions which create this sort of opportunity are so rare that passing them up simply isn't an option. I could sarcastically point out that this gives you something else to do rather than actually come up here like you know you should. Now, I wouldn't say that, would I? Perhaps the party isn't stating our point correctly. We're not actually trying to enter the GOP, and we never will. I'm not sure exactly where we got the term, but it's what we're using, so there. At the very last moment, I made the decision to live-tweet the State of the Union address, which took place 1 month ago. Since the current president of the United States of America is a nigger, the speech was awful, and a non-event, for anyone not on the racist internet. I did my best to make fun of the stupid monkey to anyone and everyone who would listen. As it so happens, my use of hashtags related to the speech managed to get my racism in front of quite a few people, albeit only 140 characters worth at a time. Even that smaller message can get attention from sources you wouldn't expect. Most of it was idiots heckling me, but a very strange thing happened. The Twitter account of the House Conservatives Political Action Committee favorited one of my tweets. Okay, that's not the most earth-shattering thing to ever happen in the history of white nationalism, but it's not anything to sneeze at either. System conservatives thought enough of something I said, despite my being openly racist, to let me know about it. Like it or not, we have to participate in these online, race-related whatever they are, because if nothing else, doing so prevents the conservatives from acting like their legitimate opposition, which forces the issue of race into the limelight even more. Well over a year ago, I played around on a Tea Party social networking website until I managed to get myself kicked off. I think I might have gone too far when I paired quotes from the Founding Fathers with quotes from Mein Kampf to show the patriotards just what their precious American values really are. But I digress. The few conversations I was allowed to have weren't greeted as badly as one might think. In fact, a few people I spoke with decided they were right for being racist, though timidly. I also got to mock one of their regular blog authors on the website who appeared to be the token nigger. I don't usually do things like this since it's almost always going to get deleted right off the bat, but it sometimes works out. And, in cases where race is already the subject, there's going to be so much screaming from every angle that it may be possible to slip things in undetected. Remember, I found the party because someone bothered to leave a link where a person, me specifically, might look to find the solution to white genocide. Now, on to background checks. I'm glad to hear the opposition to them is coming from a small minority of the audience. I'm even more glad to hear this minority is the segment we would have expected it to be. If that sounds snide, I don't really care. I would hope that most of you understand what sort of people I'm poking at here. The local party associates and I have conversed more than once on the subject of prior criminal records, and by themselves, they do not disqualify a person from work with the Northwest Front. We all know of people who have crossed Zog, and almost always for good reason, who have ended up in trouble when none was due them. Even if they were engaged in a little bad behavior, it was in their youth, and they corrected themselves of their own accord. This leads me to conclude those unhappy with the party's direction on the matter of vetting prospective comrades simply wouldn't pass muster. Either that, or they are seeking for some reason to get close to us when they know they should be allowed no such thing. And that's precisely the reason we're going to up our game. As for the new series of talks I'm starting, I intend to justify the party's stand on our major proposals and intentions once I've gone over the political realities which motivate them. Radio Free Northwest already has a Frequently Asked Questions episode, but since my material is still in the works, I'm quite happy to field questions from the listeners, should they prove significant enough to merit a place in a general political overview. Hail victory, comrades.
Got a music request I'm going to play for you from one of our more seasoned audience members, a song that I actually remember. Back in the late 50s and early 60s, before the advent of boomboxes and Walkmans and MP3 players and clouds and whatnot, people heard their music on their local radio stations, usually AM. In my case, it was usually WKIX in Raleigh. The songs they played were actually sung, not screamed. The lyrics had nothing to do with deviant sexual acts or drugs, and there were no filthy niggerized words in there, which I know you can't even say about Radio Free Northwest these days. They were just nice, pleasant little songs like this one. Imagine, if you will, a whole generation of young white children growing up not hearing every hour of every day about buggery, or how to treat your hoe, or capping the police, or the booga 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 of niggers in general, or body-pierced feminist bitches screaming their hatred of men in the guise of music. Well, this is how it sounded. This is Lonnie Donegan.
I'm gonna jump down, turn around, pick a bill of cotton. I'm gonna jump down, turn around, pick a bill of day. Jump down, turn around, pick a bill of cotton. I'm gonna jump down, turn around, and pick a bill of day. Oh Lord, pick a bill of cotton. Oh Lord, pick a bill of day. Oh Lord, pick a bill of cotton. Oh, it's on my Lord, gonna pick a bill of day. Me and my buddy gonna pick a bill of cotton. Me and my buddy gonna pick a bill of day.
And to wind up our white history section on this last day of Black History Month, here is an audio clip from Commander George Lincoln Rockwell, founder of the American Nazi Party.
You folks that are Christians and are following these, well, not Christians, Gentiles, that are following these people, you might look and see who's running your outfit. Who are you working for? Communism has nothing to do with helping folks, as I'll show a little later here. It's to put Jews in power. I'm going to show you how far these people go in screwing you, and you don't know anything about it. You're not allowed to know it, but I want to show you what they're doing to you as you sit here today. The money that they're taking out of your pocket with the utmost arrogance, and they got you all putting your little Jewish stars on to show how you love them. Well, now let me see how long you want to keep paying them for doing this. Here is a cover of a directory called Kosher Products Directory. There's a big U here in a circle. Well, now you may think we're talking about matzo balls and gefilte fish. We're not. This is a directory, ladies and gentlemen, of grocery supplies that you can find all over your grocery shelves, like Ajax Cleanser, for instance, or all sorts of Sanka coffee, almost any kind of food that you can think of. When you get out of here, go home and look on your grocery shelf, and you will find about one out of three cans and bottles somewhere buried away is this little U or a K. The R means registered and the C means copyright, but the K means kosher, and the U means Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations. The U and the K, ladies and gentlemen, mean that you have paid a rabbi to bless this chow in order to make it kosher. Well, now, I wonder what you would think. What would you think if the Catholics did this? Would you tolerate it? The Jews would be screaming, separation of church and state, this is an outrage. Why should we pay to eat Catholic food? Why should you pay to eat Jewish food? At one point, we weren't going to eat it. And we almost starved to death for a week. We had to go back and eat kosher food.
This is going to be one of those segments where people are going to chastise me on the grounds that it's not something I should be talking about in public. And I understand why they might feel like that, but the fact is that this show is one of the most widely heard throughout our tiny little subculture, with thousands of listeners every week, and a lot of those listeners are either involved or will be involved in our spasmodic attempts to put up some kind of a fight against racial extinction, be it through the Northwest Front or otherwise. So, when there's something we all need to be discussing and thinking about among ourselves, then this is the place to start the conversation, as the liberals so unctuously ooze on their posh websites. This is such a topic. We all need to be in on this idea, and by the way, just because I'm considering doing this, that doesn't mean that others of you can't do it as well on your own. The question is, should the Northwest Front revive our old email contact list? Now, some of you may remember what I'm talking about. For several years, I regularly posted and sent out a list where people all over the country, in Canada, and indeed from as far as the UK and New Zealand, voluntarily published their emails as potential contacts for local meetings and local support from other white nationalists. That list was discontinued about 2 years ago. Should we bring it back? Especially in view of the Edward Snowden revelations and the now certainty, as if we didn't know before, that the NSA and the FBI are monitoring everything we do online. Now, the purpose of that list was essentially to alleviate the perpetual movement phenomenon of the lone white nationalist, usually male and poor to the point of being destitute, who is sitting all by himself and completely isolated from human contact, or at least all white, non-liberal, non-establishment media human contact in some small rural town or some crappy furnished apartment in one of America's appalling cities. The idea was to begin to form cells and support groups of real people off-internet for Northwest migration. Now, we ran this list, frequently updated, for about 3 years, and I do know that some people used it to have productive meets with other white comrades, notably our own Andy Donner, so some good did come of it. I also know that there were a lot of head gamers on the list who wanted their address on there just to see what kind of funny emails they'd get, and who never responded to initial inquiries or actually attended a meeting, or in some cases blew off meetings that they themselves had set up. Then, about 2 years ago, the movement inevitable happened. A couple of assholes started abusing the email contact list in ways I won't get into, and we had to drop it, because the wrong kind of people were being attracted. Look, I will grant you the risk here is not small, and I was always totally upfront about that back then when I was issuing the list. In fact, only about 3% of the NF's total contact list ever took us up on it. Then, as now, most of our people were simply too security conscious or else too raving paranoid, depending on how you look at it. Risk takers of any kind are very thin on the ground here in our wee little movement, and I can't very well deny that there are good reasons for that. Just because you're paranoid don't mean they ain't out to get you, and we really do have some very bad people out to get us. On the other hand, since then, more and more in recent months, as the NF's audience widens on the net, I'm being pelted with emails, most of whom I know are totally legit, from white people of all ages, genders, and stations in life all over America, who are screaming, insofar as you can scream on a computer, for someone local in their area to just meet with them and let them see a friendly white face. You need to understand that probably the majority of the people who engage in pro-white activity on the internet have never before personally met one single other white nationalist face-to-face. I say again, 90% of our so-called movement has no existence outside the internet. Now, one of the worst problems that racially conscious whites face is the chasmic loneliness of being the only one-eyed man or woman in the country of the blind, the crushing sense of isolation that makes us eventually doubt our own sanity. Eventually, our thoughts turn to some dark channels. Hey, if everybody else around me says that black is white and up is down and the sun rises in the west and sets in the east, then maybe it is me who's out of step. Maybe the liberals really are right and all of this is in my imagination. Maybe the real world really is on television, on the Cosby Show, and the crime shows where the FBI are heroes, and not out here in this world I see around me every day. Maybe I really am crazy and I need professional help. Maybe Arianna Huffington and Chris Matthews and John Stewart and Rachel Maddow really do speak with the voice of God. Now, right now, I've got a kid in Michigan and a middle-aged man in San Francisco. I think he's middle-aged. And a woman in Southern California and intermittent other people sobbing on their knees at my cyber doorstep, begging and pleading for someone who will just meet them in a McDonald's so that for a few hours they can talk and say nigger in front of another human being. Plus, as the NF grows, and it is growing, this could potentially be a valuable tool to work people into the migration idea so long as we can keep the dysfunctionals and the undercover agents and the FBI's $400-a-week men and the goat dancers away. Always that proviso in our wee little movement. There's a post on the Homeland blog right now that discusses this, where you can add your comments if you like. Just go to northwestfront.org and you can find it. I haven't yet decided what I'm going to do about it yet. So far, the comments seem to be running about 60% favorable. And of course, this would be entirely voluntary. And if you don't think it's a good idea, then you don't have to participate. Now, we would need to tighten up security quite a bit. For instance, you'll need to get a separate email address, Yahoo or Hotmail or Gmail or whatever, for your racial communications. I will not allow any emails to be published that contain someone's name, for example. I would need feedback from you. We will operate on a one-strike-you're-out system. If someone promises a meet and then they don't show, then that's it. They're off the list. I will need feedback on those who don't respond to contacts. There will be a whole safety protocol that will need to be understood by everyone. First meeting in a public place. No telling anyone where you live until you have gotten really to know them and like their vibes. And even then, you need to be careful. Break off the contact at the first sign of mental instability or criminality or talking about illegal activity, that kind of thing. And yes, I know the goat dancing loons will howl and shriek that the mere fact that I would suggest this is some kind of quote-unquote proof that I'm some kind of deep dark fed, all their usual drivel. Well, to hell with them. What they think about anything doesn't matter. This is something that has proven to have both good and bad results. It is very much a use at your own risk and walk into it with your eyes open proposition. You will need to understand that in the vast majority of cases, I do not know the people who will be listing themselves personally. I do not in any way vouch for them, and their presence on the list does not imply that I vouch for them. I won't list them if they don't look okay to me on the internet, but hell, anybody can look good on the internet. It's what certain kinds of trolls do. Now, the risk is there, but so are the potential rewards. Our subculture is tiny, numbering possibly 10,000 active internet participants. More if you count the operations of strong paleocons like Willis Cardo and neocons like Jared Taylor. And running into the millions if you want to count Tea Party types and Limbaugh fans, which I don't, but the fact is that from the time anyone white gets involved in right-wing politics of any type, they're always slowly, slowly easing towards racial consciousness and nationalism. Knowledge and political awareness among sexually and mentally normal white people always starts at a given point and then moves rightward for their entire lives. That's one reason why we get so many racial nationalists in their 50s and 60s. It's just taken them that long to wake up their ideas. We need to start getting our act together so we can take advantage of that fact. Now, one of the services this party needs to provide for our own people, and one which we can provide even despite our current limited resources, is to try and breach the terrible isolation that I described earlier. Yes, there is risk, and before I proceed, that is going to be thoroughly discussed. Let me know what you guys think. And now here's an anti-gun control song for you from the old sod.
We remember back in time, the year of 69. You unleashed your dogs of war into our street. We could not stand idly by and let our families die. We fought you back and joined the IRA. So stuff your fucking crown, we Irish won't lie down and gave away our guns to a foreign land. No Semtex, not our guns, will you ever get from us? You can stick your decommission up your ass. Well, you murdered 14 young men, and you'll do the same again. Decommission you will never, ever see. As long as we have men, like the famous fighting men. Yes, those famous fighting men from across the land. So stop your fucking crown, we Irish won't lie down and give away our guns to a foreign land. No Semtex, not our guns, will you ever get from us? You can stick a decommission up your ass. They were Ireland's bravest men. We will not forget the ones who fought and died. Decommission you can see will never ever be, 'cause the IRA will always be around. So stop your fucking crown, we Irish won't lay down and give away our guns to foreign land. No Semtex, not our guns, will you ever get from us? Stick your decommission up your ass. You can tell the RUC, those black bastards from Dunkey, they will never march down Gervahi Road. Never, never. If you want to make a fight, we will stand up for our right. You can take your fucking march and give us peace. So stop your fucking crown, we Irish won't lay down and give away our guns to foreign land. No Semtex, not our guns, will you ever get from us? You can stick a decommission up your ass. Now tremble, you're an ass, if you think that it will last. Six counties are under tyranny. You can tell we Tony Blair and Momo Lumber if you care. They can stick the decommission up their ass. So stop your fucking crown, we Irish won't lie down and give away our guns to a foreign land. No Semtex, not our guns, will you ever get from us? You can stick your decommission up your ass. So stop your fucking crown, we Irish won't lie down and give away our guns to a foreign land. No Semtex, not our guns, will you ever get from us?
IRA will always be around.
Well, I was going to wind this up with my usual closing tirade, but I just got word the comrades come in from out of town, so he and I need to get together for dinner. And so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban, freedom.